Construction meets the world's most popular board game in new Monopoly Construction Edition. Amass or possibly lose great fortunes. Every space on the board is packed with both iconic construction brands and incredible infrastructure projects in this new exciting edition of Monopoly. You'll need to make smart decisions to come out on top. Have you got what it takes to succeed in the world of construction? Search Construction Monopoly to order now.
It's Wednesday, the 22nd of June, 2022, and this is Reconstruction, brought to you by the Construction Index with me, David Taylor, and my colleague, Phil Bishop, editor of our daily online news service. Good morning, Phil. Is the sun shining there in Maidstone or wherever you are?
It's shining so much, I've had to draw the blind so that I can see my screen.
Oh, dear. Yeah, what are we doing indoors? It's ridiculous. Okay, well, it's been a couple of weeks since we last spoke, on the podcast at least, so quite a lot has happened in that time. What particularly has caught your eye this week, the last couple of weeks, I suppose?
I think it's all about materials, isn't it? It is,
actually. Yeah, a lot of stories about materials.
Different types of materials and importing and exporting materials and things like that. I'd like to
yes,
start
indeed.
Off with a inflammatory report, a very gung-ho report from an organisation called British Association of Reinforcement, entitled "Is Cross-Laminated Timber a Potential Trojan Horse?" Now, you and I, David, have been around reporting on the construction industry for long enough to remember the arguments that the steel and concrete lobby used to have over whether you know tall buildings were better being steel framed or concrete framed, and they would commission all kinds of reports to show that our product is better than your product and your product is dangerous and your product is expensive and our product's much better and all this, that and the other. And it always used to be concrete v steel, these wars. Now the curious thing about BAR, the British Association of Reinforcement, this is the organisation where steel and concrete come together.
Yes, that's true.
And so the BAR, where steel and concrete come together, instead of attacking each other, they're now attacking timber.
Yeah.
And they're having a go at specifically cross-laminated timber, which is slithers of wood stuck together with glue, put crudely, I think.
Massive plywood almost. Yeah, I guess so. same sort of principle as plywood. Of course, I mean, it wasn't really a thing. Sort of 20, 30 years ago, you know, we're talking about structural frames here, and you know, you had a choice. It was either reinforced concrete or it was steel. And as you rightly say, there was a lot of competition at the time for supremacy in that particular sector. And if you remember, the BRE, the Building Research Establishment, did some fascinating sort of full scale. Fire tests at Cardington in those big airship hangars. Do you remember that?
I do. Where
they built eight story buildings and then set fire to them to see how they performed. Because there were quite a few high profile fires in unfinished steel frame buildings. Minster Court was one in the City of London. Another one was, what's that development north of Liverpool Street? Broadgate. I think there was a fire there as well. Oh. And the steel frames buckled very badly. And of course, the reinforced concrete lobby seized upon this and said, you know, well, you know, our frames wouldn't do that. So yes, it's a blast from the past, really. But the object of their aggression, I suppose, is cross-laminated timber, which, as I say, wasn't really a thing back then. It was probably in its infancy, but now they're building high-rise buildings out of cross-laminated timber in Scandinavia. And I think that the thing which sparked this off for the British Association of Reinforcement is the fact that the City of London is considering relaxing its planning regulations to allow multi-storey buildings built with CLT frames, and that they think is a step too far. It's, you know, it's beyond the pale for them.
Yeah, well, they actually say it goes against planning laws introduced in 1666 after the fire of London.
Right.
And what I love, I mean, I'm all for it's our job, isn't it, as journalists, to ask questions and not take things for granted.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's good whenever someone comes up with a Wonder product, say, hang on a minute, what about this? So I don't have much problem, in fact, quite enjoy one product dissing another product to sort of really interrogate the claims behind it. I think the BAR report, is CLT a Trojan horse? It does slightly over-egg the pudding and weakens its argument by throwing in references to the Great Fire of London, suggesting that suddenly the whole of London's going to burn down. It talks about carcinogenic chemicals that have been or sometimes used in the glues toxic recipes and toxicity hazards, and it's quite colourful.
It is very colourful, and it's also very wide-ranging. It goes after engineered timber.
On every front.
Yeah, on every front. So it's sustainability. I mean, a lot of the... It makes the point that engineered timber products are, if you like, fashionable because of their sustainability, their environmental profile. And there's a lot made, of course, by the timber industry of, you know, the fact that it's a renewable resource and that it absorbs carbon. This is, sort of sequestrated by the growing timber and all the rest of it. And the fact that it's wood timber frame buildings are pleasant environments in which to live and work and all that sort of stuff. And also the fact, which, of course, timber has made a big point of saying, is that actually timber performs very well in fire, which was really the thing which concrete had over steel back in the day. Of course, they say, well, you know, timber burns, wood burns, which is true. But there are lots and lots of tests, not least the test done by the BRE, I believe, which showed that actually timber burns, but quite slowly, and initially at least, it forms a sort of a protective layer of carbon on the outside of the actual timber. It chars rather than burns particularly. Well, BIR say, well, I'm sorry, but timber's also a fuel, we burn it. And so they are really going all guns blazing after this. And I think you're absolutely right. They sort of protest too much in a way. They've undermined their own argument by being a little bit over the top, I think. And I think also another thing was this report, which is a very interesting reading, and I think it does raise some genuine points which deserve sort of more examination. But it doesn't cite any references. There's no...
it's not very academic.
There are no footnotes. Yeah. There's nothing that you can sort of follow up and say, "Oh, I'll go and read that and see, see where they got this from." It doesn't provide any of that. It's basically stating its case without any attempt to back it up, which I think weakens the argument slightly. But it is interesting to see that they are clearly, they've really got the wind under their sails and they're going for it big time.
The only thing it doesn't do in its full sort of Al Murray pub landlord rant, it doesn't sort of say, well, it sort of does. It talks about the transport cost, the embedded carbon related in importing all this timber from Scandinavia. But it only hints at, rather than absolutely says, we don't want any of that foreign muck coming, being brought from overseas into our country. We should be using good British quarried stone and good British sand. Yeah. It doesn't quite wave the flag, but there's a hint of it in there as well, isn't there?
Yeah, there is. And I suppose, are we still self-sufficient in aggregates and cement in this country?
I think we probably are. Pretty much. I think some still comes in, and a lot of the sea dredge stuff comes from, I don't know, it all comes from British waters, or whether sometimes the trawlers stray beyond the boundaries, I don't know.
Which I suppose you can't say about timber, because, I mean, there have been, we've reported recently about attempts to try and make the UK self-sufficient. There's a Scottish project.
We're a long way from that.
Yeah, to try and find, it's a long way from being self-sufficient in timber. So they've got a point there. But, I mean, aggregate, stone, cement, gravel, sand and gravel, are finite resources. And although we might have pretty healthy reserves, they're not going to be replenished. You know, once they're gone, they're gone.
Very recyclable, though.
Yes, that is. Yeah, that is true. That's very true. You can crush up, and people obviously do. They crush up and reuse concrete to produce aggregate. So you can recycle it probably more easily than you can engineered timber, because as you know, BAR makes the point here, it's full of chemicals, you know, glue, not the least of it being glue, fire retardants and pesticides and all the rest of it. And it's full of nasty stuff that makes it difficult to recycle.
I think you and I think both of us are still broadly fans of wood and of timber. I think we like it as a material.
Yeah.
And we see all the problems that the concrete lobby's got. But were there any aspects of the pro-concrete report that you thought, yeah, okay, I'm with them on that? I think that's a strong point. I'd like to read more about that.
Well, yeah, that point which I just raised about recyclability, I thought that they do have a point there, because, you know, timber can be recycled. People were talking about reusing structural members, you know, steel and concrete, actually reusing them and not crushing them and recycling them. And I don't think you can do the same thing with timber at all. I mean, it is, you can make paper and cardboard out of it, I suppose. You can grind it up and make chipboard.
But can you get rid of the glue out of CLT when you take it apart?
You probably can, but whether or not it's practical to do that, I don't know. Because, I mean, you know, it's not like, I made a comparison with plywood at the beginning of this conversation, and I said it's a bit like plywood. I mean, it is layers of wood, you know, oriented, you know, with a grain at 90 degrees or whatever, and glued together, just like plywood is. But I think, you know, CLT, you're talking about big pieces of wood. I mean, you know, sort of several millimeters thick, which you might be able to delaminate mechanically, and then, I don't know, either grind off or dissolve the glue that bonded it, and then chip it up and turn it into chipboard or MDF or something like that. As for the other products which are in it, well, I don't know. You know, we've talked about pallets before and how pallets are used. I think 75% of particle board, as they like to call it, everybody else calls it chipboard, is made of recycled pallets. I think they're treated with fire retardants and stuff like that. So presumably that's not an obstacle to recycling. Glue, don't know about that. I imagine if you've got a really large proportion of the material being chemicals, that will interfere with its performance when you try and recycle it or turn it into something else. But you probably can recycle CLT. But the thing is, steel you can melt down again, and you can, you know, smelt it and mill it again and get steel out at the other side. You know, it's still steel. Concrete, you can't get concrete out at the other end, but you can get high quality fill, you know, type one aggregate and that kind of thing. Timber, well, you can make other board products out of it, but, you know, it's a process of diminishing returns, recycling, isn't it? You can't, with the possible exception of steel, the product you get after the recycling process is not the premium product you started with. Whether or not CLT is at a disadvantage there, I'm not sure. I don't know enough about the technology. But the thing about timber is that, and this is what the timber lobby like to remind us of all the time, is that as trees grow, they absorb carbon from the atmosphere. Most people know that. Anybody who's done, you know, sort of GCSE biology knows that plants, as they grow, absorb CO2 and they give out oxygen, which is great stuff. So, you know, that's why we plant trees. If you then burn that wood, if you harvest the timber and then you burn it for fuel as biomass, you instantly release all that carbon into the atmosphere. And this is why I'm very skeptical about biomass technology when you're talking about burning virgin timber. But if you make something out of that timber, you make a product and that is embodied in furniture or a building or something like that, then so long as that remains in use, then that carbon remains locked into that product and it isn't released back into the atmosphere. But of course, eventually it reaches its end of life and it either rots or it's burned, and you know, we get the carbon back out into the atmosphere. And I think the balancing act is, you know, how long you can keep that carbon locked away, because typically in a softwood plantation, a tree will grow for, I think, at least 40 years, possibly up to 80 years before it's harvested. Now, even if you release that carbon back into the atmosphere slowly over a period of 10 years, that's still maybe 60, let's say 60 years of carbon sequestration undone in 10 years. Well, that's not a win-win, is it? Where am I going with this argument?
Is it undone? You're saying that the 60, all the good stuff the tree has done is completely undone as soon as it's chopped down. Is that what you're saying?
It's not. And what I'm trying to say is that if you use that timber as a material, and that material has a long service life, then you can, if you like, break even in terms of carbon, because if you can keep that carbon locked away for long enough, then it will, when it finally gets released back into the atmosphere, it won't have been released prematurely, if you like. So you're not actually, the thing is that if you chop down a tree and then you burn it, all that years of carbon sequestration goes straight back into the atmosphere in hours. It's not really an environmental benefit.
Apparently also the decomposing stump that's left behind continues to release CO2 for years, according to the BAR report.
I think that's a dodgy argument, because in a managed forest, and they do make the case that, you know, these aren't proper forests, these are basically crops. In a managed forest, which is being managed for timber production, you know, you do chop down the trees, leave the stumps and the roots in the ground, but you immediately plant new seedlings to replace the trees that you've chopped down. And they, all right, then it takes a while for them to get going, but they immediately start growing. And as they're growing, they are absorbing carbon. So yes, those tree stumps, which are left in the ground, will rot down.
But the forest as a whole, or the wood plantation
as a
whole. Yeah,
they won't rot down in days.
Yeah,
exactly. It'll take them years to rot down, by which time, you know, you've already got saplings which are maybe, I don't know, 6 meters high. So they're absorbing the carbon. So I think that's a very
spurious argument. Okay, it sounds to me that we don't buy the concrete lobby's argument, or the steel and concrete lobby's argument, about trees not being green. We have some sympathy for the not very recyclable angle. The one which I found the most interesting, recyclability is something that it is right and good and proper to think about when you're putting up a new building. But frankly, I would hope that if I'm commissioning a high building in London, I would hope that it would outlast me. And really, as far as I'm, purely selfishly, in terms when it comes to my money, what happens at the end of the building's lifetime, I'll be worm food by then. So don't care. What I do care about is how much it will cost me, A, to put up the building, and this is not discussed at all in this report.
No.
And B, how much it will cost to run the building, which is discussed, although they don't talk about it in the cost of electricity bills. I mean, they talk about it in terms of the carbon emissions during the operation of the bill, which is equivalent, basically, to electricity bills, to energy bills.
Yes.
And they say that the concrete's heavyweight thermal mass can play an active role in reducing heating and air conditioning requirements. Lightweight construction is far more reliant on mechanical air conditioning. And I think that, I'm sure there have been lots of studies done on that, but that to me, that's not the only key argument, but the most important argument that I think needs to be drilled down. If you start building high-rise timber buildings, one, how long are they going to last? Because that's uncertain. Mm-hmm. We don't know what the design life is. Two, is what will it cost to run the building over its over its lifetime? What's the whole life cost? And I don't think we've got that information at all, have we?
I don't know. I certainly haven't got that information. I do know that's an argument that the concrete frame industry was making two or three decades ago anyway, when they were arguing against steel, for example. They always talked about thermal mass and the thermal flywheel effect. You know, you talk about on a boiling hot day in Spain, you walk into a cathedral, it's nice and cool. You know, it's you walk into my office here, I've got a fleece on because it might be sunny outside, but I'm semi-subterranean here and it's still quite cool. You know, you don't get those massive temperature fluctuations in a building which has a high thermal mass, which concrete does have. You know, it absorbs heat. You know, storage heaters, remember those? They're basically big cabinets full of bricks, weren't they? You heated the bricks up overnight with cheap electricity, and then you opened the baffles in the morning and they let that heat out during the day. It's the same process. So they talk about this thermal flywheel. It sort of flattens out the peaks and troughs. And that certainly was one of their main arguments when they were felt themselves in competition with the steel frame industry. And it's just as valid when you're arguing about timber. I mean, timber is a good thermal insulator. I don't know whether or not that mitigates the effect. Obviously, heat doesn't travel through wood as quickly or as easily as it does through steel. I don't know how it compares to concrete in that respect, though. So, yeah, they've probably got a point, but I think you can, if you look at modern buildings and you look at houses, for example, we talk about modern method. Well, we don't. People talk about modern methods of construction. They usually mean timber frame, don't they, in houses. And one of the problems with modern houses, which are timber framed and highly insulated, is the risk of overheating. But you can manage that. You can manage temperature fluctuations within a lightweight structure. There is a technology to do that. So although I think that inherently a concrete structure will be perhaps easier to control in terms of its thermal performance, I don't think it is necessarily impossible to do the same thing with timber. But again, we're getting into very scientific areas here, and I'm afraid I'm not qualified to comment.
I think we need to move on to another topic anyway, but I just want to give the last word to Timber Development UK Chief Executive David Hopkins from the Timber Trade Federation. He said, "This report brings nothing new to the table other than a desperate attempt to smear a sustainable construction material by those sectors which have a less than positive tale to tell about their environmental impact." Mm. So,
yeah, and we haven't actually mentioned, have we, the cement industry's contribution to global warming, because I think, is it about 7 or 8% of man-made carbon emissions are from the cement industry? Something like that is massive.
I think that's well known. We've talked about, we took it as read that people knew that. We've talked about that quite a lot.
Yeah.
And I think this is all part of, concrete's trying to hit back. But let's move on to asphalt.
Yes, indeed.
Now, this is a story this week, not exactly new, but two press releases hit our respective inbox on the same day, within hours of each other. One from Tarmac, which is a CRH company these days, and one from Aggregate Industries, both effectively saying the same thing, that they are moving from hot mix asphalt as their standard mixed road surfacing material to warm mix asphalt. Now, warm mix has been around for a while.
Yeah.
And they've been using it more and more. And the statements were coming out the same day say, right, this is now our default. Tarmac, they've got 40 plants across the UK. We're moving to warm mix for all lower layer materials and they're phasing out traditional hot mix asphalt for highway projects. And that company alone expects to save 13,500 tonnes of carbon dioxide a year. Again, it's an environmental thing, but there are other benefits. For the motorist in particular, is that the roads can be reopened much quicker.
Yes.
Or flip that on its head for the contractor. They can work for much longer up until the road. If you've got an overnight motorway closure, whereas before you had to get everything done within, let's say 3 hours and then 5 hours resting. I don't know what the numbers are. Now you can work for much longer, do many more hours work and get much more road laid.
Okay, I think, because I was a bit puzzled about that. I mean, warm mixes which remain workable for longer, but you can open the road earlier. I thought, well, surely those are sort of mutually
yeah,
exclusive.
Yeah, yeah.
But I can see, but basically, I suppose, is it because it's a lower temperature, it cools down and goes hard quicker?
Yeah,
is it as simple as that?
So. I think so, yeah.
Oh, right,
yeah.
Okay.
Well, at least you can drive on it.
Yes.
So, yeah.
Yeah. You're right. It has been around for a while, although I think we've heard more about warm mix asphalts in the last, I'd say, 2 or 3 years, well, 3 or 4 years perhaps, particularly. And I assume that that's because the technology has sort of matured and it's been proven. And, you know, and I think over the last couple of years, every time somebody's laid a road surface with this stuff, we've had a press release about it. So they've been quietly promoting the technology for a long time. But I've always found, it's funny actually, because we're talking about steel versus concrete. There was also another materials battle going on around the same time, which was concrete paving versus asphalt paving.
Oh, thank God, and asphalt won that one. I can't be doing.
Yeah,
concrete,
me too. There's nothing. There are stretches of the M25 and the M3, which is still a nightmare. But
you have to turn the radio up so loud that you can't hear the police car chasing you.
I can remember once, many, many years ago, when I was a kid, driving up to see my grandparents. Well, I wasn't driving, obviously, but my mother was in our Volkswagen Beetle, driving up from Margate to Dartford to visit my grandparents on the M2. And all of a sudden, there was this whining noise coming from the car. My mother was frightened that there was something wrong with the car, the wheels were going to fall off or something. It was this really quite loud whining and sort of squealing noise. And we didn't know what we were looking for, but we walked around the car a couple of times and we noticed that all the other cars whizzing past us were making this squealing noise as well, and that it was actually the road surface. So, yeah, horrible. Concrete paving, horrible.
Worst noise I ever had in a car, which has got me very worried, was I was driving to the airport after, it was actually the morning after my wedding reception, had the wedding night in a local hotel, driving to the airport, and my car was making a dreadful racket, and I was really quite panicky, and I couldn't work out what it was. So I had to pull over and say, got out, looked around, and I hadn't realised getting into the car that someone had tied a couple of balloons to the aerial, and it's the balloons banging against the roof of the car.
I thought you were going to say that you forgot you had left a Bay City Rollers cassette in the car stereo.
Wasn't that long ago.
No. Where were we? We were talking about asphalt,
hot mix asphalt.
But the point I was going to make before I got sidetracked myself was that the highways industry or sector is very conservative with a small C. I know porous asphalt, that was a revelation, wasn't it, many years ago when they started laying that stuff, wonderful stuff. People were worried about its longevity, that it wouldn't last, it was porous, therefore you'd get freeze-thaw damage and all the rest of it. You get clogged up with detritus. And yet, it turns out that porous asphalt's fantastic stuff and everybody who drives on it likes it. But I think the people who are promoting that technology were battling against, you know, a resistance. People had never used that material before. They knew hot mix asphalt, traditional asphalt. They were quite happy with that. They knew what they were doing, and therefore they didn't want to change. And I think that maybe, you know, this slow acceptance of warm mix asphalt shows that they're being, you know, playing the long game. That they've established its credentials, and now they think it's safe to say we're shifting to this.
I don't think it is that. I think it's more to do with the whole environmental thing.
That's true.
Basically, the warm mix it's got less fuel in it, but additives instead, and those additives add cost. I don't actually know what the additives are. I lack that expertise. And significantly, I don't know who produces them, whether aggregate industries and tarmac have got a duopoly on producing the aggregates, or whether the aggregates come from some, you know, I don't know, BASF, third-party German chemicals company or something. I don't know. So the person who has the greatest vested interest in this move financially are the people who produce the additives.
But yes,
there is this carbon reduction advantage, and clients, particularly public sector clients, are now prepared to pay extra for environmental benefits. That's now become part of the specification, part of the evaluation of what is a cost. You know, cost is not just money; it's carbons as well.
Sure.
And I don't know what in this country, the difference in cost is, but I've just Googled how much more expensive is warm mix and hot mix asphalt. And this American site said it's between $3 to $5 more per ton than hot mix asphalt.
That depends on how much it is a ton, really. I mean,
And if it's £1 million a ton, then that's nothing at all. But so yeah. I don't know what the percentage terms is, but yeah. Good point. I've no idea. But there is clearly a cost there. Whereas in the past, everything's all been purely driven by
cost.
Lowest price today. Which is possibly why we're making those horrible concrete road surfaces for a while. Was that cheaper than I don't know? But this is all part of the green agenda. That's what's driven it, I'm sure of it.
Yes. Yeah, I think that's true. And I think it's also supposed to be nicer to work with because, I mean, obviously the hot stuff is fiendishly hot for a start and stinks, not to put too fine a point on it. You know, you've got the fumes and the smoke and goodness knows what else. Well,
my mother tells a story that when she was a child, this is not in the days when, you know, a child with a cough and a cold was given a cigarette to smoke to clear their throats. She wasn't given a cigarette. She was sent out to stand by the roadworks.
Do you know what? I had a friend who told me exactly the same thing. So maybe it must be true that people actually thought that bitumen fumes were good for you. I suppose it's because back then...
It cleared the passages.
Yeah, it certainly did. And I suppose it had antiseptic properties. But of course, back then, everybody used to wash with Wright's coal tar soap, didn't they? Which smelled... I mean, I don't know if they still make Wright's coal tar soap. God, here we are, like a couple of old... I can still remember this. But Wright's coal tar soap actually smells like hot mix asphalt. It really smells like bitumen. And you associate that smell with sterility, cleanliness, that kind of thing. So that's probably why it was. But I don't think that bitumen fumes are good for you, after all, despite all they said. So that's another benefit of that. And of course, it's the fact that you don't have to burn up so much fuel getting it up to temperature, which must save a lot of energy.
But the move from hot mix to warm mix asphalt becoming standard for the two majors was only one of three, I want to say tarmac, asphalt-related stories that we've run the past couple
of
weeks.
Yes, yes.
There's another one, a research by Nottingham Transportation Engineering Centre at the University of Nottingham, working with Kent County Council, and Amy, the highways contractor, have been working to assess the pros and cons of using... Now, I've only seen this word written down. Is it gyp pave, guy pave?
I don't know. I mentally pronounce it GI pave, but it's actually spelled GIPAVE. So it could be guy pave, jy pave, gyp pave, gyp pave. We should have chosen a different name, quite frankly.
Whatever it is, this is a proprietary product made in somewhere overseas. Swiss company, I think.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's a product that's got a graphene-enhanced supermodifier.
Mm.
Let's read it out here. GIPAVE is a graphene-enhanced polymeric supermodifier that involves melting pellets that contain graphene and recycled plastics into the aggregate mix when the stone is mixed with bitumen.
Mm.
And apparently the results have shown that these little plastic, carbon-reinforced plastic pellets melted into the asphalt mix extend the life of the running surface by 2.5 times over the non-GIPAVE alternative. So again, yeah. 25-year instead of 10-year life expectancy.
Which is quite impressive if it's
a hell
true.
Of a thing, a hell of a thing.
Yeah.
And lifetime cost, 32% cost saving. Obviously, it's going to cost more to put this additive in your mix, but if the road surface lasts 25 years instead of 10 years... That's a big saving. Net result, 32%. So I think that's quite wowy.
Yeah, I think it's amazing. It's a bit like magic, isn't it? Because I mean, we've all heard of graphene, but I have really no idea what it is. I mean, you know, it's like this sort of magic material which was invented by a scientist in Manchester. And it's obviously something to do with carbon.
this is what they told me on... It wouldn't even mean Tomorrow's World, it's more recently than that, but this is what they told me on the telly. You get the tip of your pencil and a razor blade and you scrape the tiniest bit off the tip of your pencil. It's smaller than that. And it's stronger than something very, very strong.
Right, okay.
It's invisible, but absolutely minuscule carbon filings.
Yeah, but these little carbon nanoparticle things, I suppose I ought to actually sit down and read about them, but isn't it something about them being essentially two-dimensional materials, which I find really hard to get my head around? You know, how could something be a material, but only in two dimensions? I don't know. But and what is it? Graphene nanotubes is another thing. I mean, how do they make them for a start? I mean, I find it fascinating to think about how people make, I don't know, hypodermic needles, let alone graphene nanotubes. But anyway, whatever this stuff is, it's magic, because if it can do this, if it can increase the lifetime of a road surface by 2.5 times, that's, yeah, it's got some incredible properties.
I wonder how much of that is the graphene and how much is the plastic. If you didn't add graphene, if you just did the plastic pellets alone, how much longer would the road surface last then?
That's a good question. Because, I mean, recycled plastic isn't a new thing in asphalt mixes, is it?
Oh, we've run lots of stories over the years about people putting, you know, plastic Coca-Cola, waste Coca-Cola bottles and things like that.
Is that a Scottish company? MacRober, is it? Are they?
MacRever,
yes. That's it. A sort of repair asphalt using recycled plastics. Which is great, because I mean, you know, we all know that waste plastic is a big problem, and if you can reuse it in an asphalt mix, then that's fantastic, because effectively problem solved. Yeah, I'd like to know what the contribution of the magic graphene material is in this product. But I imagine it must be doing something. It's not just a marketing exercise. But anyway, they've been working. Is it just in Kent? They've been testing this.
Well, it's University of Nottingham, but I think the actual road trials have been in Kent. Dartford, is it? Because it's okay. Amy is the contractor working for Kent. Kent Highways have been at the cutting edge of materials science, civil engineering materials science for as long as I've been writing about construction, probably longer. They seem to have always figure in these stories, Kent Highways.
Yeah. Interesting. Well, you should, you're not that far away. You should drive up to East Hill in Dartford, Phil, and then you can drive up and down the road and tell me what you think.
Maybe I will. Give it a scratch. Scratch and sniff. Anyway, the final, quickly, asphalt story, which is completely over my head. It's aggregate industries again. Something called biogenic asphalt. Did you read this one?
Yes, I did.
In Cumbria.
I did.
Explain it to me. I don't understand it.
Well, I don't. I can't explain it to you, because I don't know what the biogenic element of it is or how it works.
It's very vague. It says that it's a... it's called super low carbon asphalt made by Aggregate
That's
Industries.
That's it, yeah.
And it uses Shell's super low carbon bitumen in a formula that uses alternative energy sources to lower its embedded carbon footprint. It includes a biogenic material that effectively locks carbon dioxide within the asphalt rather than releasing it back into the atmosphere. That's quoting the blurb. Now, I quite deliberately, because I didn't know what biogenic did, when I posted this story, I put a link to a definition of biogenic substance in Science Direct. The journalist in me wanted to explain it, but when I went to read what a biogenic substance was, this is what I found. Biogenic substances are exposed to oxidative destruction by increased generation of free radicals, causing many incurable diseases like cancer, atherosclerosis, cardiovascular disease, diabetes, blah, blah, all sorts of... And it just goes on. It goes on to Parkinson's disease. It goes on to the role of it in microbially induced concrete corrosion, chemical formulae. It got incredibly complicated paper from sciencedirect.com. That's beyond me. I'll just write the word biogenic. I'll put the link there, and clever people than I who want to know what that means go there and see if you can work it out, because hell, I couldn't.
From the description you just started to give, it didn't sound like very nice material, actually, if it's all to do with free radicals and cancer and various other horrible ailments. But I imagine if you're just going to stick it in the road, it doesn't really matter. Just for the record, Aggregate Industries says that this material effectively locks CO2 within the asphalt rather than releasing it back into the atmosphere, which would seem to suggest that all the blacktop over the country is sort of like seeping carbon out into the atmosphere all the time.
No, it's not seeping, it's locked. It's locked. The key's turned.
Yeah, no. But the biogenic stuff is locked. But they seem to suggest that other asphalts don't have their carbon locked in. So it's all sort of, you know.
Oh, I see.
Ooh, it's sort of right. Oozing out into the atmosphere. That seems to be the, I don't know. Again, this is another warm mix asphalt, this one, the biogenic one. So maybe it's just like, you know, tarmac's warm mix asphalt, but, you know, on stilts, as it were. But, yeah, the biogenic element really went over my head, I'm afraid.
Yeah, I tried, but yeah, the days are too short, even at this time of year. I wanted to talk about the Construction 2025 document, which was written in 2013. Now, we're getting close to 2025, and I think it's important to look at, you know, to look at how the industry, led by, in this case, Construction Leadership Council, is getting on. Now, let's remind ourselves what the four targets that were of Construction 2025. A 33% reduction. All these reductions are from the 2013 baseline. A 33% reduction in both the initial cost of construction and the whole life cost of assets. Well, I think the cost of construction is probably, notwithstanding materials price inflation, which has sort of scuppered all of that. But on the whole, I think progress had been made there.
Yeah, I'd agree with that.
A 50% reduction in overall time from inception to completion for new build and refurbished assets. So there's been some achievement there by bringing contractors on board. Early contractor involvement has helped reduce time and other initiatives. There's been some reduction there. I don't know if it's 50%. I can't imagine it is. A 50% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions in the built environment. I think we might have already achieved that off the top of my head. I would guess that that is the biggest, oh, the biggest success of the four targets that we've made. I think that greenhouse gas emissions from 2013 to 2022 have come down enormously, possibly as much as 50%. I don't know. But the fourth target is a 50% reduction in the trade gap between total exports and total imports for construction products and materials. And I repeat that, products and materials. It's not talking about services, it's not talking about invisible things, it's talking about things you can touch.
Yeah.
Now, that last one is the one I want to flag up, because it's the one that no one ever talks about anymore. So I kind of want to keep it out there and say we should be talking about it. Trade is important. Today, instead of having halved, that figure has more than doubled. In 2021, the gap was $13.2 billion. By government's own figures, the balance of trade deficit in construction products has widened from $6 billion to $13.2 billion. It's more than doubled.
Yeah.
To put it flesh on that, in 2021, we imported $20.5 billion worth of construction materials and exported 7.3. So the gap has doubled since the Construction Leadership Council has been trying to halve it. It's all gone completely the wrong way. So I sent an email to the Construction Leadership Council a few weeks ago, and I said, is this target of halving the balance of trade in deficit in products and materials, is this still a target for the Construction Leadership Council? Because the Construction Leadership Council, remember, was set up specifically to deliver on these four goals set out in the Construction 2025 document. This is its remit, to do these four things: build quicker, build more cheaply, build greener, and reduce the balance of trade. It's made progress on three, and it never talks about number four. So is it still a target? And here's the reply. The 2013 target is focused on construction products and does not include services, despite the UK having a competitive advantage in these exports. The CLC works closely with the Department of International Trade to increase UK exports in products and services, including digital technologies such as BIM. Successes include over £100 million worth of BIM exports to Peru, as well as exports of services to countries all over the world. So look at that. I'm asking a question about products and materials, and the answer comes back, yeah, it's still a target, but we're great at services. We've always been great at services. Our consulting engineers, you know, Arup and Atkins and Alexander Gibb and partners have been designing dams all over the empire for decades. You know, I mean, this has never been a thing. It's never been a problem. How can we get, you know, more work for Arup overseas? That's not what this is about. This is about physical imports and exports to reduce the balance of trade deficit. And even when you ask them specifically about it, they go, yep, it's still a target. Look at all these services we're exporting.
Yes.
So we need to keep talking about this.
Yeah.
I sent an email to a few people saying, do we care? Does this matter? What's the government doing wrong? What, you know, was it always an unrealistic target? Should we be expecting more of the government? What are your thoughts on this all going in the wrong way? And didn't get many replies, to be honest, but someone from the Mineral Products Association, Dan Casey, who runs the cement side of the Mineral Products Association, and nice full circle here, says the current push to use and therefore import more timber for construction, well, that's part of the story. So, you know, we've got domestic products we could be using, but say, no, let's use imported products instead. That's a political choice based on environmental issues that we've talked about. And I asked someone who I thought would give me some sort of, you know, damn the government, they should be doing this, that and the other type of answer, who is Edward Naylor, Chief Executive of Naylor Industries.
Oh, yes. Yep.
Naylor Industries make clay and plastic pipes and drainage products. So nice, proper, old-fashioned construction products that are, you know, used, humdrum, made in Britain and imported. And he was surprisingly phlegmatic about it. He said, it's hard to read too much into these figures. While it's clearly in the nation's interest to narrow the deficit, I think we've been through a period of abnormal demand for construction materials. And I'd be surprised if the deficit doesn't narrow when normality returns.
Hmm.
But I'm not sure I buy that, because the 2021 gap of 13.2 billion is not some sudden spike or sudden blip. It's been climbing since 2013 to 2021. It's been climbing steadily, pretty much, from 6 billion to 13.2 billion. It's been up and down a little bit. It dipped in 2020. It was only 10.4 billion in 2019, 9 billion in 2020, back up to 13 billion in 2021. The deficit narrowed in 2020, not because we were suddenly exporting lots and using homegrown products, is that we weren't exporting or importing much.
Yeah, exactly.
The whole swimming pool shrank and there's just less going on. So I think we can exclude 2020 as a blip. But if you say, if you look at 2019, 10.4 billion, 2021, 13.2, and it's been fairly steadily going up.
Yeah.
So the deficit, 9 billion. Interesting, other figures out recently, construction machinery trade gap. We are net exporters of construction machinery. We've talked about this before.
Yeah.
We've got the first quarter figures for 2022. Balance of trade surplus for £256 million. Again, not huge when we're talking about £9 billion overall, but for construction products. But for construction machinery, we sell more than we import. Although I have some slight concerns about those statistics, because a lot of machines that we import from Britain are made from imported components and quite high value imported components. So I'm not quite sure whether the exported machine outweighs the imported components, if you know what I mean, or the,
yes,
the balance
of
trade.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I don't quite know how that, but so I find it, I'm not quite as excited about the exports. I mean, it's good and it's positive, and I'm glad it's a surplus. But I think.
I mean, how much of that is JCB? I wonder. You know.
Well, JCB's obviously got high British content, but it's not JCB. Yeah. I mean, as Komatsu and Caterpillar have got big, you know, manufacturing presence here, but. I don't know whether, you know, how much British content, how much domestic content there is in Cat and Komatsu.
And do they export from the UK? I suppose they do to Europe.
I don't know, but I'm sure they do. I would imagine
Europe, Africa, Middle East. Yeah. I guess. Yeah, yeah.
I mean, some of these export import export stats they get corrupted by odd countries like Holland and Belgium, Netherlands and Belgium, which are hubs. You know, things are imported into. Holland and Belgium have got the European bases of Asian manufacturers or whatever, mm-hmm. and that things are imported there and then exported again. So I think if you look at there's a table somewhere that I've seen that shows that I think it's Belgium is something like the third biggest exporter. Netherlands third, Belgium fourth, biggest exporter of construction machinery to the UK, that is, where, you know, clearly we've got more Korean-made machines than Belgian or Dutch machines in the UK, I'm quite sure. But I think the Korean machines, you know, land in Europe somewhere else before they come here.
It is interesting to see that the Construction Leadership Council basically just simply ignores the issue. You know, they won't address it, even when you ask them directly about the balance of trade. They will sort of glibly say that the target still stands, but immediately move on and talk about a completely different topic. That's clearly something's not working there, and they're not prepared to face it.
I think they take their lead from. It's a different minister every year at least who co-chairs the Construction Leadership Council.
Yeah,
and I think the government agenda is on carbon and efficiency, basically, between taxpayers' money. Now, of course, trade is about money. You know, we want the more we can export instead of import is good for the economy. But I don't know. Maybe it's because the Department for International Trade is now separate from BEIS. I mean, it used to be Department for Trade and Industry, and those two things were together. Yeah. And BEIS, which is a sponsoring department for the Construction Leadership Council, has no remit for international trade. So maybe it's simply, hey, we don't care. This is not our.
Yeah.
We don't care if we make Liz Truss look bad. She's the trade secretary. She can sort it out. We're not doing it.
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe I'm sure I'm being glib there, but I think.
There might be something in it.
I think the Construction Leadership Council needs to be reminded that it's got four targets, and one of them is to reduce the balance of trade deficit, and it needs to pull its finger out and do something about that. And it's done a lot of great things, but it's ignored that one.
There's one thing I wanted to mention, Phil. We mentioned JCB and construction equipment exports. There was a story this week in the on the BBC News website, which was quite interesting. Headline was "How Bulldozers Became a Vehicle of Injustice in India." And this is about the fact that the BJP, which is the ruling sort of Hindu nationalist party in India, is a rather, let's say, gung-ho outfit. And being a fairly sort of reactionary Hindu-led establishment, they've got it in for the Muslims, which isn't a new thing. But people who Muslim critics of Narendra Modi, the BJP leader and prime minister of India, have been attacked, and also, and this is the thing, their houses are being demolished by the government because apparently they're built without planning permission. And so they're built illegally and they need to be demolished. So there was one or two activists, a chap called, a political activist called Javed Mohammed, who I think lived in Allahabad or Prayagraj, as it's now known. I don't know if I pronounced that correctly, but it's a Hindu name rather than a Muslim name. He had his house knocked down by the authorities because apparently it had been built illegally. And this has now become a thing that BJP supporters actually go to rallies holding plastic toy construction equipment and waving them around because it's become a symbol of, if you like, resistance against these people or sort of, you know. But the trouble is, it's bulldozers this and bulldozers that. And it's even become a meme. I can't remember. Stop bulldozing Muslim homes, for example. Stuff like that. Every single picture on this news story, there's not a single bulldozer there. I mean, I'm being a bit techie here, and perhaps only plant people will appreciate this. Not a single bulldozer in the story. The people waving construction toys are waving toy backhoe loaders, and all the pictures show excavators, 360 degree hydraulic excavators with JCB logos all over them, which is really bad news for JCB. They don't deserve that sort of tarnished reputation. There's even a picture of somebody holding up a placard saying, "Stop JCB over Muslim homes." So poor old JCB.
but I suspect the backhoe loader is the tool that's been demolishing the homes, and they just call it a bulldozer. It's bulldozing, i.e. knocking down.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So the pictography, if you like, is correct. It's the vocabulary which is wrong.
It is.
And they probably will be. I mean, it's not JCB's fault. It probably will be JCB's because they absolutely own the market in India.
Yeah, that's right.
I can see how it happens. I mean, if you're successful, it's, you know, you're going to be... It's like Coca-Cola get blamed for making young children fat, even though there are other fizzy drinks available.
Yes,
well, that's because you're the biggest, you know.
And this isn't the first time stuff has happened like this, because I can remember back during the... showing my age again here. But back during the Islamic Revolution in Iran, when there were mass execution, public executions in Iran, pictures all over the international media of people being hanged from Grove cranes. And this was a big problem for Grove.
I thought they were Tadano cranes, weren't they not?
I think that's probably more recently. Back then it was definitely Grove.
Okay.
Yeah. But they can't help it. You know, once you've sold the machine, it's not up to you what people do with it. And if they want to knock down people's houses or hang dissidents from them, then that's just a tragic accident that you can't control, really.
That's your and finally item. I've got a quick and finally item. We've talked about this before at length, and I don't want to do so again, but it's worth just placing a note on record that National Highways has lost its application for retrospective planning permission to infill Great Musgrave Bridge in Cumbria. The Eden Council Planning Committee unanimously decided that they couldn't keep this little old bridge infilled with 1,600 tonnes of foam concrete and structural fill, and they're going to have to dig it all out again. National Highways have said, OK, it's a fair cop, we won't appeal, we'll do it. And I think that probably signals the end of that whole endeavour. And
yeah,
the person I feel sorry for in all of this is a woman called Helene Rossiter, who I've never met, but she is the head of... you might think, why do I feel sorry for her? She's the head of the department. She's head of the Historic Railways Estate Programme at National Highways. But I feel sorry for her because she has been forced to come out and defend and explain this every step of the way. And the more national newspaper manure that has been heaped on top of her head, the more she's been made to just go, nope, you're on your own, you're the only person, you're fronting it. And
yeah.
I thought it was very interesting to see a tweet from a man called Richard Bowker, who is quite a well-known industrialist. He was chief executive and chairman of the Strategic Rail Authority at one time, which is, you know, not exactly analogous to highways, National Highways, but another Department for Transport, you know, agency body type thing. And he says, he tweeted after this announcement, "I've never been big on and now heads must roll, but on this occasion at least, the chief executive of National Highways must formally apologise as well as scrap this policy of unwanted vandalism." And I agree with Richard Barakat. I think the CEO of National Highways should have come out and should have stepped up and instead of making Helene Roster face all the music, you know, said that we as an organisation, I'm the head man, you know, I take responsibility for this, and he should have faced the music. And he, well, as far as we can tell, he's just ducked it.
Yeah, it was a case of deputy heads must roll rather than heads must roll in this case.
Oh, very good. See, I'm not even sure Helene Roster is a deputy head. I don't know what level she is in terms of the hierarchy. I suspect Historic Railways Estate, until all of this nonsense started, you know, came to public consciousness a year or two ago, I suspect it was quite an obscure little broom cupboard of a job. I mean, it's become an absolute poison chalice for the woman. I
suppose it is on her desk, though. I mean, that's her department, isn't it?
Yeah, okay, but I think it's not unreasonable when the heat gets so hot that bosses should step up and help out. I mean, that's, you know,
they don't
do
that anymore,
do.
Phil. Look at our Prime Minister. They don't do that anymore. When the proverbial hits the fan.
Allegra Stratton was the only head that rolled.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
So I thought it's just worth a comment.
Well, we've been going for a long time, Phil, chatting away like nobody's business. So are we going to call it a day?
I think we are. We'll be back again in 2 weeks' time when it will be July. Blimey.
Yes, indeed.
But once again, from Reconstruction, the Construction Index podcast, from David and I, thank you very much for listening and goodbye.
Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.